Hello, this is Andrew Corbett, and welcome to our Bible study series, Different, an examination of the Apostle Paul's epistle to the Colossians. We're looking at study number 10, which is Build a Different Home. Now, just to point out, all of Paul's epistles essentially follow a pattern, and that pattern is one where he lays out theology, and from theology, he then builds practice. In other words, this is what it means. This is how it applies. So with that in mind, he's been building a theology, a series of doctrines on the supremacy of Christ. And Paul's epistle to the Colossians it should be read almost concurrently with his epistle to the Ephesians. They were sent at the same time. They are sent essentially to the same audience. And Paul's epistle to the Ephesians was meant to be read by the Christians at Colossae and vice versa. So what you'll notice is that there is a very similar pattern between the two, with the exception that Ephesians discusses the body of Christ and Colossians discusses the head of the body. So with that in mind, we're now into the very, very much the practical section. In other words, because Christ is supreme, this is how you should live. And we're looking at build a different home. So again, if you're able to start your meeting with an opportunity for people to get to know each other, which may include, if you're able to have socializing over drinks or over food or snacks or tea, coffee, whatever it is, that's an ideal way. And then move into the arena where you can invite people to share something that they're thankful for and something they would like prayer for. Now, as a group leader, what this is doing is it's building community within the group, because the group then gets to share how their world is being shaped. What's happening in their world? Have they had a high? Have they had a low? No, I don't mean high on drugs. I mean some exciting news. And then by taking note of the prayer requests at the end of the meeting, you can then pray. You can remind the group of those prayer needs, and you can again have the community of the group being built and established. So that's one of the reasons why we would do that. All right, so this is Build a Different Home. It's based on Colossians chapter 3, verses 18 to 24, which we will unpack now as we go through this study. When the epistle to the Colossians was written, people generally lived in households. Now, that's a very deliberate term, and we today think of a household as mum, dad, and the kids. But back in the day of the Apostle Paul, back in the Roman Empire, it meant something different. Now, I've got three references there, which you may want to refer to. One is John chapter 4, verses 53. The Father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. Another one, Acts 18, verse 8. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. So there's one more. First Corinthians chapter 16, verse 15. "Now I urge you, brothers, you know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia, and that they have devoted themselves to the service of the saints." So these are just three examples of what I'm just about to unpack now by looking at this word households. This frequently included a family consisting of parents with their children, living with members of their extended family, aunts, uncles, grandparents, and live-in servants as well. Roman households were built upon a hierarchy, but Christianity revolutionized the way families and households interacted with each other, and it's a big but. So you don't, I mean, if you're an English grammarian, you know, you really should have that continue on from the previous sentence. But I wanted to emphasize this. There actually really was a major significant bend in the road when Christianity came into the world. It radically changed the way husbands and wives, parents and children, and household servants to their masters related to each other. We'll have a look at that. Question one, in what way does Colossians 3:18 sound as if the Apostle Paul is reinforcing this basis of Roman culture? So Colossians 3:18 says, wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Well, that just sounds like Paul is saying, this is the way everyone does it. This is the way you should do it as well. Keep doing it. And in what way does it sound? That's how it sounds. It sounds like he's reinforcing Roman culture where the wife is inferior to her husband. But what we're going to see is that as we look at the flow of the apostle's thought, we're going to see that he is going to radically elevate the status and role of women and children and servants. And it's going to be built upon an understanding that all people are created equal in the eyes of God. Now, this is going to be just absolutely radical. But it's interesting to note from the outset that this would have sounded like what Roman culture was all about. So now we go to question two. Question two, but why might Colossians 3:19, which says, Colossians 3:19, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. So Paul's obviously correcting something in the culture. Love your wives. There's the first correction. And I'll make a point about that in a moment. And do not be harsh with them. So how might that have sounded so shocking to Paul's original audience? And does it affect the way we understand Colossians 3:18, the verse we just read, which said, wives, submit to your husbands? Well, here's the thing that I hope, as you have a bit of a discussion about this, and there may be some people that do appreciate Roman history, but let me just point out that in Roman culture, men did not always marry for love. Often, they married for purposes of status, to sire children, and would often have a mistress in addition to their wife. And in Roman culture, this wasn't necessarily frowned upon. Now, added to this, using prostitutes, bizarrely to us today, was not regarded as something immoral in Roman culture. But here, Paul is stating that a man's wife has an exclusive status, an exclusive role within the marriage, within the household, to play in her husband's life, and that the husband is to treat his wife with the utmost care and love, not to be abusive, not to be harsh at all. Now, I want to make this point here. I don't normally try to get preachy in these Bible studies, because I want you as a group leader and your group to discuss these things and to self-discover. But I want to make this point because we live in a society, in a culture, in an age now where domestic abuse is so prevalent, even in the church. In fact, there are entire Christian groups that use scriptures like wives submit to your husbands for men to justify physical, verbal, financial, psychological abuse of their wives. And that is a distortion of the New Testament teaching. So I make this point. Colossians 3:19, which we've just looked at, which says, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. That verse removes any justification for a husband to hit, harm, or maliciously hurt his wife. Now, I put in the word maliciously hurt his wife because sometimes in just the cut and thrust of relationships, we say things in love that hurt. So hurt is not the same as harm. But if we're saying it to harm, that is a malicious hurt, then that is wrong. And I was also thinking, well, what if she's involved in an accident and her husband happens to be a surgeon who has to do some immediate roadside surgery? That might hurt, but it might also save her life. So that's why I've put the word maliciously in there. Christianity radically transformed how husbands and wives are to relate to each other, but most importantly, how husbands are to treat their wives. Based on Ephesians 5:25 and 28, husbands are to love their wives in the same way that Christ loves his church. While this goal might seem unattainable for most husbands, perhaps a great place to start for a husband is to go for a regular walk with his wife and give her their undivided attention, or his undivided attention. And I'm putting that in, so for, well, let me finish the sentence. Gives her his undivided attention for the duration of their walk. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that now you don't have to listen to her, but I am saying here is a great place to start. It's a little bit of romance, just going for a walk and talking. If more husbands and wives did this, I think our world would look different. Now, I'm just suggesting this as a place to start. I'm certainly not saying that's the only thing a husband should do. I think husbands should also take their wives out on a regular date, and all the wives will say amen to that. All right, so that's something I don't normally do in these studies, but I really am very, very strong about this. Question three, why should children obey their parents according to Colossians 3:20? How then should a child respond to a parental command which violates God's law? All right, so Colossians 3:20 says, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Now, again, you can see how that could be abused by a wicked parent. So I've got the sub-question, how then should a child respond to a parental command which violates God's law? So I'm thinking, what if a stepdad wanted to do something untoward and have their child participate? Okay, so let's have a think about this. So my response might be, children should obey their parents because their parents represent God. That's the very first principle. That's the principle Paul has there. But there is this echo, which, you know, as unto the Lord. So in one sense, a child who obeys their parent, who has instructed them to disobey God, bears the greater accountability. In other words, the parent bears the greater responsibility. So that's the first thing, especially when the child is very young, that the accountability is more on the parent. Now, in another sense, when the instruction is so immoral and so irreparable, the child should take whatever measures they can to disagree with and withstand their parent. So if the parent says, here's a gun, it's loaded, take it over and shoot your brother, that child should not obey. That child should do whatever they can to disagree with and withstand their parent, especially if their parent has mental illness or is substance or alcohol induced. That changes everything in that instance. So I think we need to get a balance here as well. Because the New Testament teaches that fathers are to represent God, and here's the blanks, the Father, first word, the Father. They are to treat their children in a way that reflects God's heart and character. Question four, based on Colossians 3:21, list three examples of what fathers should not do to their children. So Colossians 3:21, fathers, do not provoke your children lest they become discouraged. So I guess in the simplest sense, on the surface of it, it sounds like, well, fathers should not provoke their children and they should not discourage their children. What's the third one, you might ask? Well, this is because I want you to, and I'm hoping that as a group leader, you'll get the group to think this through so that it's not just, you know, read text, fill blanks. It's actually, let's think this through. What does provoking look like? Well, it looks like harming, hurting. It looks like being cruel. It looks like teasing. It looks like putting down. It looks like mocking. How many have I given you there? There's about 10. And don't do those things, you know, that discourage. Fathers should not discourage their children. Fathers should be the coach on the sideline cheering their children on. So you'll never amount to anything. You've always been a failure. You've always been a disappointment. That kind of stuff should never come out of a father's mouth. Never. So there's a list of examples, and I'm sure that in the discussion you can come up with some more. Here's some general categories. A father should never abuse their child verbally, physically, in the misguided notion that this is them disciplining their child. Secondly, they should never discipline their child in anger, because oftentimes when that happens, they're punishing, not disciplining. And there's a difference, a huge difference, between disciplining and punishing. And thirdly, they should not discourage them from obeying them in the future. You know, what's the point if I did what Dad said and I get this? Or from developing their relationship with God the Father. And that can look like a dad who is an absolute terror to their child through the week, bundles them up in the car, comes to church and looks like tries to look like an angel. Children see right through that, and it's completely discouraging for their own relationship with God. Now, here's a statement. Again, I try not to be too personal in these things, but I'm just going to make this statement. I have never met a perfect father. Never met one. I have never met a father who hasn't got angry at their children at times and done and said things in the heat of that anger that they later regretted. But I have met humble dads who have shared with me how they have, at times, had to go to their child or children and apologize for their angry outburst and ask for forgiveness from their child or their children. Question 5. The Roman Empire was dependent upon slaves. We know that many of these slaves turned to Christ at the preaching of the apostles. For example, the Epistle of Philemon gives an example of this, where the runaway slave, Onesimus, is being dealt with. Because the gospel meant that a slave was equal to their master, how might Paul's instruction in Colossians 3:22 seemed out of step with this revelation? And was it? So Colossians 3:22 says, "Bondservants, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord." Now, I've got a note here. Also refer to Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 to 8. And Ephesians chapter 6, verses 5 to 8 says, "Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by way of eye service, as people pleasers, but as bond servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free." So, in light of that question, Paul is telling bondservants, that is slaves, to obey their masters, even though they might not be Christians. Thus, rather than being out of step with the gospel, Paul is reinforcing their obligation to serve the one they are contracted to. Interestingly, Paul uses this same Greek word for the lowest slave, and the Greek word is doulos. Doulos. So Paul refers to himself as a doulos of Christ to describe his relationship with Christ. Now you'll see that in Romans chapter 1 verse 1, Philippians chapter 1 verse 1, and Titus 1:1. And there's a couple of others as well, but those are three that are easy to remember because they're verse 1 of those epistles. Question 6. Although Paul is addressing the relationships within the households of that day, what principles are there for us from Colossians 3:23-24, which says, "Whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ." So from that, what principles are there for us today? And how might the original recipients of this directive have applied it? Well, the principle for us today is that if we are employees, we should work for our employers as if we are working for Christ by giving our best work effort. The principle that these first century bondservants would have heard was that they were now serving their masters as if they were working for Christ as their master. Now, I close with this little prayer. May God help each of us to be agents of His peace, love, and forgiveness toward the members of our families and our workplaces. Amen.